Jack, we did lose you a couple times on your audio. You went Robo Man.
I did.
You did.
Yeah. It almost sounded like an auto tune, you know. So.
Oh, really? Did I sound like Cher?
You could start singing.
Do you believe in life after love?
Howdy. Welcome to the Idea to Impact podcast. I'm Dr. Beth Durmeyer, your education concierge at Texas A&M University Innovation Partners. If you are an entrepreneur or an inventor looking for the inside scoop on how to tackle that mysterious black box that is commercialization or technology transfer, then you, my friend, have stumbled upon the right podcast. Here, my co-host Jack Manheyer and I will bring you stories from inventors and entrepreneurs who have managed to be successful while surviving and thriving in academia. In episode one of the Idea to Impact podcast, Jack and I talked to Dr. Mark Benden from Texas A&M School of Public Health. Mark has 21 U.S. patents for current ergonomic, health, and industrial products, and has numerous other patents pending in other fields both in the U.S. and internationally. Many of his designs were breakthroughs in the field of ergonomics and are now industry standards that have helped countless people to be more comfortable, productive, and safe while performing their work. In other words, if you have sat in a chair or used a desk at school or work, you have been touched by products driven by Dr. Benden's research. The lifetime value of these inventions has been estimated to be over $1 billion. And in case you were wondering, Dr. Benden accomplished this while teaching, researching, and holding multiple appointments across the A&M campus. If you find yourself wondering how you can fulfill your work responsibilities while pursuing your dream of being an inventor or an entrepreneur, stay tuned to hear how it's done. Let's get started. Welcome to the Idea to Impact podcast. This is the show where you will hear from inventors and entrepreneurs who have amazing stories of how they have taken their research from and ideas from pencil to paper all the way to market. I'm Beth Durmeyer.
And I'm Jack Manheyer.
And today on our show, we have Dr. Mark Benden, who is department head and associate professor in the Environmental and Occupational Health Department, as well as associate professor in the Industrial and Systems Engineering Department. He's also the director of the Ergonomics Center, which, Dr. Benden, I am sure you all have been really busy these past few months looking and trying to understand how working from home is going to impact employees with the way that we're sitting. I know that we've had some conversations about how sitting has been not good for us over the past few months. So it'll be interesting to see how, or what you guys find out, how it's going to impact, you know, A&M employees as well as employees all over the country and the world. So we're really excited to hear about that.
Definitely. Glad to be here.
Jack and I have known you for a few years now, but
right,
we want for our audience to get to know who is Mark Benden. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Mark. Maybe talk about how you got to be here at A&M. What's that story?
Well, it's a story of about 1,500 miles, I guess. I was raised in Southern Maryland, and while going to high school, I got interested in both engineering and medicine, and all the rage at the time was to combine those two into something called biomedical engineering. And I discovered for me personally, that was just a way to not have to make a decision. So I just avoided medicine or engineering and chose the thing that was the combination of those two. So, you know, it was a real quick search at that time for schools around the nation that had a program at the undergraduate level. There really just were a few of them, and most were very expensive private schools, quite a few back east, a few out west. And then there was Texas A&M with an undergraduate program. And so their out-of-state tuition was cheaper than a lot of places in-state tuition, and certainly much cheaper than the private schools. And, you know, I was coming from a blue-collar family. My father was a machinist. My grandfather was a coal miner. So I was first-generation college, and we really had no clue or concept about this thing called college. And so it was really just a matter of they had the major, and it seemed like a great adventure to launch out into to Texas.
And this is a good story. Jack, we've heard the story, so Mark, you've got to tell it. Tell us about you arriving in College Station for school.
Absolutely. Of course, I had applied late, not understanding all of the concepts of deadlines and so forth. And so I came down by myself over the summer for, I guess they call them, new student conferences. And when I arrived, having been on an airplane for the first time, flying across the country by myself, still 17, hadn't turned 18 yet, I showed up at the registration point that I think it was the pavilion at those days, and waited in line outside in the heat for a few hours, and then finally got up to the counter, and the very helpful lady there said, "Well, where will you be staying?" And I said, "Well, in a dorm." And she said, "Okay, well, which dorm?" And I said, "That's why I'm here to talk to you. You're supposed to tell me. I'm coming to college. You
ready?
Me
ready
a dorm.
For a billet assignment, man?
Yes.
Right?
give me my dorm thing, And she said, "Well, did you sign up in the spring and get on the list? The lottery or whatever?" And I of course had no idea what she was talking about. I'm like, "No, I'm coming to college. You give me a dorm. This is the thing, right? You live here.
This
you go
is
to
how
school
it is
here.
On TV.
Yeah, I've seen these movies." Mm-hmm. And she said, "No, you had to have done all that ahead of time. And so, with I think less than a month or so to go until school started, she said, you're kind of out of luck." And I said, "Well, how am I supposed to do this? I don't, I can't just come down here and live by myself. I need a place to live. I'm assuming that there's some things on campus." And she said, "You're out of luck." She said, "Now, if you wanted to join the Corps of Cadets, you could get guaranteed on-campus housing." And I said, "Oh, well, what's the Corps of Cadets?" And she said, "Oh, well, it's kind of like this, like a fraternity sort of, like a little bit of a military twist." And I was like, "Oh, well, that sounds pretty good. I get housing?" And she's like, "Oh, yeah, you guaranteed to get housing." Okay, well, sign me up for that then, give me that dorm. So that's how I ended up in the Corps of Cadets.
And for those who are listening who don't know about the Corps of Cadets, the Corps, much like VMI or the Citadel or Virginia Tech's Corps of Cadets, is a highly regimented military training program of 4 years that allows some folks to accept a commission in the United States Armed Services, and others go on just to other positions and gain the leadership. But it's far from a fraternity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, maybe some of the craziness and, silly late nights and...
Yes, there are certain elements that would qualify to
so an auspicious start for someone who's gone on to become a major influence on campus but also in the marketplace. I mean, Mark, I saw your stuff before I met you, and with the sit stand desk, some of the ergonomic things that you had invented, we were using in our office already.
Yeah.
And when we met, you're like, "Oh yeah, I invented that."
that's been fun to be able to go out in the community and in industry in particular, and of course now schools, and kind of notice your handiwork in certain places and even industries now that have kind of grown up around certain inventions, and the opportunity to see offshoots and even knockoffs. People get upset sometimes about that when someone knocks off one of your inventions. Sure. I still take that kind of as a compliment. So it bothers me a little more when they knock off my invention and theirs is better. That part bothers me a little bit. But that's part of the game.
You bring up a good point, and I want to get to this late. I'm going to get to this later. But my understanding is that you created the sit stand desk technology that you did for educational purposes primarily. Right, you were focusing more on a learning environment that was ergonomically sound and was healthy, and yet I see it now, having been translated more into the corporate, more of the corporate sector than the educational sector. So it's interesting that you start sometimes with your invention with one application in mind, one impact in mind, and it might meet that impact, it might miss it and go somewhere else, it might hit it and then hit a few other ones too and ping pong around. Yeah. You see that happen often with the things that you do?
Absolutely. I mean, it's really common for most inventors to have kind of those moments where they pivot or the industry pivots. You know, things change constantly. I mean, we see all sorts of iterations and aberrations that happen. I actually started in the adult, industrial world, moved into helping adults with sedentary behavior in offices, and then took that technology. The CDC had contacted me about the work with adults and said, you know, is there something we can do for children that will help them move more? Huh. And so that was back in about 2008 or so, I guess, when the CDC reached out. And so we started exploring, you know, options with children. You know, can we get them to do that? And it was so much easier with kids because adults really have been lulled into this, kind of coma of complacency around their physical activity. So they're very sedentary, very inactive today compared to in years past, particularly with our jobs and in high tech and so forth. But children like to move. They like to wiggle. They like to dance. They like to squirm. It's not really hard at all to get them to move. In fact, it's typically hard for the younger ones to get them to be still, which it turns out is not something that's natural to us as humans. We are taught that. We practice it. In fact, most of us probably have perfected it, which is, again, not a good thing for our health. And so the kids were really natural. They took to it very easily. I was shocked at how motivated they were and happy they were with the chance to have a kind of a physical outlet, the chance to move and wiggle during the school day.
So, Mark, can you think of something you said that some, or Jack talked about, like sometimes you have an invention and you envision it for this industry and then you go to license it out. Maybe it's a university invention and we're licensing out and they're like, no, we're going to use it for this. I mean, how have you always been like, oh, okay, that's fine. Or has there been a change as you've matured? Are you okay with that? Do you still kind of take it personal? What is that like?
Yeah, it's really part of the process. I think as an inventor, you have to be willing to have those moments where what we call the, you know, kind of the commercial embodiment, right, of the art. So you have your art and you often have your intent for your art. In fact, a lot of times that's the picture that you put on the patent. You know, that's the sketch of the thing in your mind that you've dreamed up and it's sort of place you want to apply it. And then there are commercial embodiments that flow from it, that come out of that, and things that really come later from that. And that's been one of the most awesome things about the iSchool is that they now have the patent vector software. And so the patent vector software, for those of you not familiar with it, it's an opportunity to look at patents and see what has come from those patents. And the way that works is just like a journal article. You write a journal article, later some of your peers will publish something reasonably close to that, and they will cite your article, your original article. And there are sort of these seminal, you know, research journal article topics that are out there. And so for years, decades sometimes, people will cite a particular article because that was really the first time that someone published research around that topic and had that discovery or that breakthrough or that sort of way of thinking or even an innovative approach to collecting, say, data. And so patents are the same way, and intellectual property and these concepts and ideas that turn into inventions and later commercial embodiments are the same way. They trace a history back through because they cite other patents that are close but not quite, right? So similar but not exactly the same thing. And to get a patent, you need to be novel. You need to be original. And so not only is that novel in the way that something is applied, but more importantly for the patent office, it's novel in the way that it's designed and that it works. And so this is hard because a lot of people get confused with patents and they think, well, I've got this idea. Great. That's a, that's a good step. That's a step in the right direction. Have an idea. You know, like today I have an idea for a car that flies on water. You put a little bit of water in it and it flies. And that, I mean, I don't think there's anybody on the call who would think that that's not a great idea, right? I mean, like Fantastic. A car that Let's just puts it. A little water in it and I'm off you go. Pre-order one.
Yes.
The problem is I have no mechanical methodology, yeah, to execute that. Mm-hmm. And so to get a patent, I would need much more than just the idea of a flying car that flies about on water. I would actually have to have a process and a methodology. And that process and methodology would need to be something that people who are skilled in the art in the fields that it approaches, whether it was the automotive industry, engineers or chemistry, you know, chemists, it would need to be something that they could look at that and go, yeah, I can see that. That would work. That's cool. That's mm-hmm. a breakthrough. Yeah. And they would agree on that. And so, you know, a lot of times we struggle with this idea around patents, but it's very similar to journal publications in the sense that you have these original ones that come, and later, even though your thing might today be for COVID-19, in 5 or 10 years, it may be used for some other disease we've never even heard of. Right. And so this is the cool thing about patents is that we have those breakthroughs that lead to others.
That is so true. And you know, looking at patent vector and, you know, realizing that there's seminal patents that people, you know, have to cite when they're submitting new ones. You know, it reminds me of my oral exams during my PhD yeah. grad school, where you know that you have to cite certain people because they were just the originals.
Yes.
And if you don't
yes.
cite them, they're like, well, do you really know what you're talking about?
Yeah.
And for our listeners, we do have a patent vector course that you can take on A&M's CPED website. And Dr. Andy Morris and Andrew Torrance, who's one of the creators of patent vector in the course, talk about how how you can trace things back and you can see how one patent, which is not connected to anything else, how it's pivoted. For example, we found a beekeeper's knife that was cited in a patent where somebody took the little tube that's in the beekeeper's knife and is using it as a catheter in your heart. And who would ever think that a beekeeper's knife would have anything to do with heart surgery? Or
that's awesome.
Right. Yeah. So patent vector kind of naturally puts those things together and then you find out what the results are, right?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Mark, it sounds like you've had all these ideas and you've been doing this for a while. What is that first memory that you can think of where you were an inventor or an entrepreneur? What is the first memory you have of that?
Oh boy. Well, as I mentioned, my father was a machinist because he had a machine shop, I was able to tinker, had my own workbench when I was probably 2 or 3. I think as soon as I could walk and was potty trained, I had my own workbench and tools. And so lots of tinkering and time, spent creating. And I think there's probably some generational differences today. You know, my father certainly would instruct and guide, but he did not feel the need to do things for me. So he would let me mess up and make really ugly stuff that no one, only a mother could love. And, you know, in the process of so doing, learn. And so I was really fortunate in that sense because I was able to be, I would say, a true apprentice. And if you think about it from a historical perspective and go back thousands of years and think about, you know, people like a blacksmith or a farmer, you know, apprenticing their family members as they were raised, that isn't something that's really that common today in our culture. I don't believe that most of us have the opportunity today in our careers to truly, on a daily basis, apprentice someone in our family. And I think that's kind of unfortunate because I think that process is so important. And it certainly was for me at a young age to learn to both invent and also to be an entrepreneur and to learn about business was to have that chance to be an apprentice to someone. So early on, lots of crazy inventions and making things that, like I say, were pretty hideous. Later figuring out how to sell some of the things that were a little bit more appealing and probably just family members who felt sorry for me initially to buy some of those crazy creations. But yeah, I think those early days really helped form me and helped set in my mind that, you know, if I had something that I wanted to see come to life, I could make it. I could build it. I could create it.
Do you have an example? Still, do you have a favorite example or at least an example you're willing to share?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so I guess on the invention and creation side, I had made ring holders to a lot of ladies in the family were complaining about their rings falling off while they washed dishes. This was before dishwashers, of course. And so I made some little brass posts and attached them to some polycarbonate, and you could set that. It was reasonably attractive. You could set that on your kitchen counter and you could put your rings on that heavy post. And of course, finish doing what you were doing, you wouldn't lose your rings. And then you always knew kind of where they were if you needed to take your rings off to do something dirty or wet or whatever. And so those were quite popular. They were all the rage. I don't know where I got the idea from, but it's think genius. Probably my mother or my aunt, you know, was struggling with this issue. So
I always do that, and I just take my ring off, and I don't remember where I set it.
Right.
I do the same thing. I'm missing my wedding ring now because of that. Yeah. And I know it's at least it's in the bathroom or it's on the kitchen counter somewhere. You know, that's
well, maybe I need to go.
I'll
back
buy that now. Absolutely.
You'll buy it now. See, so there's still a market today. Oh man.
So you talk, Mark, about the you know, you grew up in an environment. So there's this kind of nature nurture thing, right? You were nurtured in an environment that you were apprenticed.
Yes.
But you also seem to have this nature element of you that from an early age, 2 or 3, you were tinkering, you were trying to figure things out, you were building things. Right. And some of us that might be of the same generation as you, but especially for those of us that are not, that are students or younger faculty going through now, that said, you know what, I missed out on that. I didn't have Mark's dad. I didn't have that spark, but I think I do now. Is it too late for me to apprentice? Is it too late for me to learn this skill set? You know, am I like Luke Skywalker and Yoda goes, no, he's too old. I can't train him. Or is there still time? Yeah. And if so, what do you recommend folks do that didn't have your unique experience? How do they get that training at their age?
Absolutely. I think there's time no matter what age you are. In fact, I think you see today, if you look across the United States, there's some statistics on this, and I'll get the number wrong, but I know it's in the mid-40s for average age of people starting a business.
Okay.
And so really so think about that. If the average is 45, we all know there's some, you know, tech.com 20-year-olds in their dorm room. Everybody loves to read about those because they end up with, you know, $1 billion. But there must be a lot of 50 and 60-year-olds, right. You know, if the mean is 45. So I don't think there's any particular age. The key to this mentoring process is you have to apply yourself to it. Now, you know, I was fortunate. I was a child. I lived in my parents' house. I was raised there. So, you know, I was around it. I was able to see that invention process. But for people today, they just need to seek it out. There are so many incubators and startup factories and business groups, entrepreneurial clubs. Texas A&M University campus is filled with different groups through the iSchool and through the Mays Business School and engineering and ag that have something to do around entrepreneurship business. There are dozens of courses. There's an entrepreneurship minor now. There's so many places that people can get involved. You definitely would want to become a student. So what does that mean? It would involve things like reading, online courses. You know, if you prefer podcasts, if you prefer YouTube videos, if you want to go to one of these massive online open courses, you know, the MOOCs, you can take those all over the country from the comfort of your home, which I guess today, because of COVID, we don't have much choice. But there are so many chances to plug in and read and learn and gain knowledge on your own, and then get that chance to be around people, be part of it. I would even say volunteer to be involved in a startup, or, you know, volunteer to help another faculty member who's maybe further along, or a student group with some of their projects, and just learn that creative process and learn the iterations and the steps. And I think also begin to understand the nature of this is, like most things, say in scientific research, which I think for a lot of faculty there may be more familiar with that, there is a massive amount of trial and error. And so it is not for the faint of heart. If you do not handle rejection well, this may be an area you need to sort of strengthen those rejection muscles a little bit, because you will be rejected. Your ideas will be rejected. Your creations, your inventions will be rejected. You will have failure. You will attempt things and they will not work. They will flop. They will not turn out well. I mean, because I do a lot of mechanical invention, I have a boneyard, graveyard, whatever you want to call it. It's the valley of death where great inventions and ideas that were complete flops have gone to die. Right. And fortunately, I keep a lot of those things around because I you know, utilize parts and pieces later for something else that does end up working or, you know, coming to pass as something positive. So, but yeah, I think that's a really important thing for everyone who wants to do this, is that the opportunity is absolutely there if you want to take advantage of it.
So that was really, you gave a lot of tips, a lot of great things, and I think they could apply to both students and faculty, but we haven't always had a really vibrant culture of entrepreneurship and innovation here at Texas A&M. And we really, that is the purpose of the iSchool and the A&M Innovation Partners, is we're trying to create this culture. So what are your thoughts on that? You know, for students, but also for faculty, how can we get faculty to think more like this?
Yeah, that's a great point. I believe one of the things we need to do is engage people not only in the process, but also the results. So, you know, the title of this process we're working on today here is Idea to Impact. And if you look at, you know, the amount of ideas generated on campus, it's so significant. And there are ideas not only in engineering and science, but also in the arts. You know, I'm at the School of Public Health. There's, you know, medicine and pharmacy and I mean, there's all sorts of different breakthrough ideas. One of the things we've got to do a better job with our community is communicating the eventual impact. So, you know, where did this go? Where did it get out there? A lot of times that could be a commercialization outlet. Who did it help? How did it help them? You know, we need to be able to tell those stories, because I think ultimately most of us, I hope most of us, you know, are really motivated by the idea of something that we work on, something, you know, the fruits of our labor, if you will, coming to help people, and the chance to have a positive impact on someone's life. And, you know, it may be something goofy and fun that just allows people to laugh and enjoy life, you know, a yard game or something crazy like that. But it really could be something that allows, you know, an older person to continue independent living for years beyond what they might have been able to had it not been for your software or your invention or, you know, your new tool or aid or whatever it is. It could be a medical, you know, breakthrough. Certainly could be something from an engineering standpoint. So there's all these different things that help with the quality of life, quantity of life. And I think we have those stories around campus, and we need to just do a better job of sharing, like today, you know, where those impacts have occurred. And I think that inspires people a lot. The process is daunting. I can't pull any punches on this. This is not, again, I tell students this all the time, you know, this entrepreneurship gig, it's not for wimps. It's tough. And, you know, it's a long road. It's not this, you know, little sprint. It is a marathon. And so, you know, if you're going to do that, if you're going to enter in that, you have got to have something out there that you're looking at, that you're watching, that you're paying attention to, that inspires you. And, because there will be plenty of moments that it would be really convenient and easy and natural to quit and give up on whatever that potential impact was.
And I know that Texas A&M does have resources to help folks along. I think it's really important to drive home what you're saying, that it doesn't alleviate the commitment and the hard work on the side of the inventor and entrepreneur. And for those listening that are at Texas A&M, or any other university that has a strong science or ag or mechanical history, I'm reminded of a story I heard when I talked to the tech transfer office over at the University of Cambridge in the United Kingdom. And they said one of their favorite stories to tell is two faculty from the Divinity School, okay? The Divinity School came up with a method that ultimately, through through coaching and through, you know, market discovery, they found it was a great method for resolving conflict. And their prime customers and clients tend to be municipalities and police departments. And now, this was a conversation a few years ago, so I can imagine that there's more of a market for that even now. But there's a story they like to tell, and I like to tell it as well, because you don't necessarily need to know how to screw in a bolt and a wing nut in order to create something that can have a major impact. And I think in this case, they didn't even know what the impact was going to be. They just knew that they had something that might work, and then through that iterative fail, get up again, fail, get up again process you're talking about, Mark, they finally found something that worked.
Yeah. Well, and so often the inventor, probably like in that case, really needs to meet an entrepreneur. And they're not always the same people. And I think we put too much pressure on ourselves a lot of times as faculty members to sort of be all of those things. So, you know, we know the stories of the people who, you know, were able to become both the inventor and the entrepreneur, you know, someone like Steve Jobs or Mark Zuckerberg. Right. And we know those names and we're familiar with those people. And one of the reasons I believe that those people are well known and successful and they're, you know, really kind of off the charts on recognition for what they've done is because they were able to do both well. And that is just not common. It's really, really rare. So that doesn't mean that every product or process that gets out there can't get out there without a Steve Jobs. There are many more examples of those things coming to market, making an impact, where there were inventors and then another group of entrepreneurs. And so I think that is much more common. So we don't want people to hear this and say, ah, well, I don't possess this trait or that trait. I can't do this. Well, no, you may be the very most important kind of cog, right, in this whole process that's missing. And you don't have to be all of them. You don't have to be all things to all people.
That's so important. I think Google might be a good example of that, right, where you have the two guys from Stanford. Right. They make something. They get it to a certain point, and they go, I don't know what to do. And they're smart enough to say, we need an entrepreneur, right? Yes. We need at least somebody from a C-suite that has the experience to take it to the next level. And they did. Yeah. That's a really important point.
And I think if you're in our audience and you're looking for something more local that maybe isn't like a big like Google, but you know, go check out the Texas A&M New Ventures competition.
Right.
And they are a prime example of a lot of them had, you know, some of them are spinouts from universities, and they have an inventor, and that inventor recognized that he or she needed mentors, needed people on the outside to step in and fill that role of CEO or you know, CEO or whatever it is. But, you know, it's okay if you can't do it all.
Yeah.
You know,
That's a great example. Those contests are really important for entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. They're great practice. I mean, it's, you not only get to go through the process of kind of pitching your idea and having other people, you know, listen to it and being able to kind of get feedback on that. You might win some money to help you when you're oftentimes kind of in a valley where you need some oomph, a little bit of a financial oomph. So those are great. But boy, you sure do meet people and run into people. And a lot of times you don't attract money, but you attract leadership or business partners or investors by attending one of those things. And again, kind of putting yourself out there in an uncomfortable spot. Nobody likes to have that moment where, you know, you don't win, you don't get the trophy, you know, you get rejected. But right. So many times people walk away from those competitions. They didn't win the prize. They weren't up front on the stage at the end, but they shook hands with somebody who ends up being their CEO or their angel investor. And that is, again, just priceless, those kinds of opportunities. So, yeah, really important.
So, Mark, this is obviously, you know, taking your ideas to the market can be hard. How did you manage to do all that, especially young Mark, like junior faculty Mark, when you were just starting on your career and, you know, you're trying to make tenure, you're trying to get your lab started, you're trying to focus on your research. How do you manage all that?
Well, I think, you know, probably for me personally, you know, faith and family come into play. And so, you know, I'm blessed with a really supportive spouse. You know, she's been with me and laughing at my crazy ideas for 32 years. I think it gives her good chuckles. Usually when I've been in the shower for longer than 10 or 15 minutes, she's kind of scared because she knows I'm going to come out and write something down. And that's always bad because that's going to involve days in the shop. So, she just usually shakes her head and she's like, oh no. What are you doing now? You know, I've got this thing. I got the, you know, okay. So yeah, well, you know, that's just part of the process, but, a little eccentric, a little crazy at times, but you know, it's all good. Great. And you know, part of that process, I think, is when you're young in your faculty tenure, there is a really clear academic, process or pressure for the tenure track faculty to follow. And it is pretty well defined. The publisher parish concept is, I would say, reasonably accurate. I think that's a fair statement. That's a simple way to kind of understand what's going on. So to publish, you must do research. To do research, you need to get funding. To get funding, you need to apply for grants. To get grants, you need to have published. So you can start to see kind of this infinite circle of non-start, right? And so somehow or another, you jump into that Venturi and, you know, you begin the process and one thing sort of begats another. And that is really critical for young faculty to be involved in that. So anything that you're doing, entrepreneur, inventor, that side that takes away from the publisher parish process, ooh, that's hard to say. That is really important that you are careful and cautious about that. So I tried as a young faculty member to look at research opportunities for grants that would possibly explore the efficacy of my designs and inventions. So will someone give me money to test my devices on humans in the field with people? Sounds terrible, but that's basically what you're asking funders to do is, you know, will you give me money to do this to see if this thing works, right? I have this idea. I even have something physical, but I'm not sure if it's going to be effective because it's...
So you're approaching it as an entrepreneur even from your grant funding, right?
You're
thinking with an entrepreneurial mindset from go.
Absolutely.
It's not the, you know, academic over here, entrepreneurial over here. It's all integrated, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's pure kind of basic research, and I would say that a lot of my colleagues would only be interested in sort of that pure basic research that only adds to the scientific, you know, body of knowledge, kind of moves the bar a little bit. And that's fine. We need that. And entrepreneurs, inventors, we build on that. We leverage that. We absolutely need those things to occur. Now, you know, most inventors at some point or another, they're going to need applied research. They're going to need to see, let's turn this on. You know, let's see if it goes boom. Let's try it. Does it help? Is it better? And they're going to need to move past that. So, you know, a great example of this you can see in automotive racing. There have been a number of breakthroughs in automotive racing that today are really common on our vehicles. All of our restraint devices, things that you would think of like anti-lock brake systems, even electronic fuel injection, they were all tested. That was their applied research on the racetracks.
Right.
And of course, they were tested for, optimal performance under the harshest conditions, right? The most G-forces, the most heat, the most speed. So when they survive in that crucible, they are easily translated by, again, people skilled in the art to common everyday vehicles. And our lives, right, are better today. We drive safer. Our families are safer on the roads and the vehicles they travel in because of those breakthrough inventions. But if you go back a step further before the racetrack, before the first application of those technologies, there was probably a chemist working with one of the polymers that went into some of the early metallic brake shoes, for instance, when we sort of got away from, the asbestos brake shoes. And so all of a sudden you've got chemists working on something that can be manufactured a certain way and can withstand heat, hoping that there's someone out there who will come up with application, right? Literally an invention without a home, without something to use that thing for. And then someone, again, skilled in the art of automotive racing says, oh my gosh, those brake shoes may not wear down. I may not have to change brake shoes 5 times during the race. That would be great. Let's get those, right? And so, you know, these types of things are all a part of our academic research university process. I think a lot of our faculty don't give themselves credit for the inventive work that they do and for how their breakthroughs lead to products later that do, in fact, touch people and make their lives better, make them safer, you know, healthier, whatever it is. So we've got to communicate these stories. We've got to help people understand where they're at in the process and how critical they are to the process.
Talk about surviving in the crucible of auto racing. I had a best friend who was an amateur racer, but it was the full racing stuff. And I didn't realize how dangerous it was until I saw his, you know, the suit that he wears, and it had his name and then said B+. I said, Ed, why do you have, you only got a B+? Didn't you get an A? He goes, Jack, that's my blood type. I said, that must be pretty dangerous then to do that. What you're talking about, Mark, is this marriage of industry, and industry isn't always the way we think of it. Auto racing is an industry in itself, married up with the pure research. And I would guess that a university environment is probably one of the best to try to help facilitate that industry and researcher matching together. Is that your experience as well?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, I think they're very closely related in the sense that they have all sorts of research. You will find industry tends to be a little more laser focused on their particular place in industry and their particular products.
Or something like that, right? Yeah.
Right. We make this kind of stuff for this kind of industry. So they tend to be a little closer to that. But wow, a lot of companies even pivot, you know, away from that. There's a great story about Singer Sewing Machine pivoting and making fighter jet parts. You know, it's like, what? And in fact, they ended up just selling off the name to a sewing machine company. They don't even make sewing machines anymore. They just make these fighter jet parts. Oh, so, wow. You know, there's lots of ways that you can see, you know, companies and universities interacting. There is a small part of the basic research that I think universities are probably better at in the laboratory, really early stage. They can afford more time and more failures and more mistakes and more iterations. And by the point that they get something that's kind of working and is hopefully going to, you know, have some value, then I think industry partnership starts to make a lot more sense. They can step in and say, okay, we want to use this for this purpose. And a lot of times, as you mentioned, Jack, the university person, you know, they're surprised. They're wow, I never thought this could be used, you know, for that thing. I didn't know there was a need even, you know, for that thing. And yet it may end up being the most important commercial embodiment of that invention.
So while we're talking about universities' role in the idea to impact journey, you've been through the process, the more formal process that most universities have. It's usually a technology transfer, or technology translation, or knowledge translation. Our office is called the Texas A&M University Innovation Partners. But it's the idea that someone who has an idea, an invention, discloses it to this university office, and then a process begins of protection, market analysis, getting it to the impact stage. I'm assuming you've been through that a few times.
Yes.
And for those who are worried about it being a big black box, which I'm sure most people listening that haven't been through it or even have been through it are saying, I don't know what goes on once I make my disclosure, you know, because I think that's a normal thing for most universities to experience. You know, whether it's based on your mistakes that you made or things that you do differently, what do you advise faculty members who are going to go through that disclosure to impact process?
Sure. I think it's, again, schooling yourself on the process itself, understanding, you know, what goes into it. You know, a lot of us, going back to the journal articles, we're very familiar as faculty with journal articles. So I do some work, some research, I write a paper, and I submit it to a journal. And it's not uncommon for that process to take 3 to 6 months. In fact, I've had it take much longer, unfortunately. But, 3 to 6 months is not shocking to try to get something published. It is really rare to get a patent in less than 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so, you're if you think about a little backwards planning, if you think about the thing being on the shelf, whatever that means to your invention, there's been a process to refine it and get it to the point where it was on the shelf. There was also a process, to make it manufacturable and source, materials and so forth. There was a process to get that patent promulgated. And again, that could be 2 to 5 years, depending on the technology. And so when you go back through that backwards planning, you can easily see how something today that I start working on, a new idea, approach, creation, methodology, whatever it is, it could take 6 to 10 years easily. And in some industries like pharmaceuticals, it could take even longer because of human trials and so forth. Now, I think we're challenging even some of those assumptions during COVID with this vaccine chase that we're on. Fingers crossed, that'll be successful and we'll have vaccines in the spring. But, it is a typical process for the patents, for the invention, to have to start much earlier and to begin and have a long journey. So I would say also for inventors, go ahead and learn a little bit more about the full landscape. Again, even though you may not personally be sort of all the pieces in the puzzle, yourself, learn about them and understand them, understand those folks that are. So an easy way to do that, one of my favorite books is written about Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And basically in that book, it talks about, the concept of being an employee. And so you're employed to do a job, you're paid to do a job, and you exchange your time, your hours for some money, some hourly rate. And even when we're salary, essentially, it's an hourly rate. It's just the hourly rate is much lower because we work a lot more hours. The next level besides the employee is to become an owner. And this is something a lot of faculty members need to explore is, do I want to take that next step and become an owner of a company that produces something that I have worked on and been a part of the inventive process? And that second level is really cool because you do get a lot of benefits. You get a lot of perks. You have the potential to earn a lot of income and really even ultimately decide how much you're paid. Now, the downside to being an owner is that you still are exchanging your precious hours on this earth, which is a very finite commodity. Mm-hmm. You are exchanging your hours for dollars. Now, you might have some say in the amount of dollars. You probably don't have a lot of say in the amount of hours, though, particularly if you're an entrepreneur starting out. You are going to work a lot of hours. I would venture to say you're going to work a lot more hours, maybe 2 or 3 times more the number of hours as an owner than you would as an employee. The rewards, again, could be greater. I think ultimately the best place for all of us as inventors and entrepreneurs to be able to get to is investor, and that's that third level. And so trying to take things that you've done as an employee and, maybe you've built up a little bit of opportunity or money or experience. You've been part of that apprentice program as an employee, as I was. And then you've been able to become an owner and sort of take that next step. But ultimately being able to be an investor, now you have income, you have money, right? Without having to give your hours for it. And I think the most precious part for me as an investor, kind of having achieved that third level, is to be able to invest in other entrepreneurs, other owners, and have the chance to sort of, give back to that community of people trying to create those opportunities and create those jobs. And when you look across the landscape, just in the United States alone, the amount of, jobs created by small business, by startups, so many of these businesses too, they don't have to be the next Intel or Microsoft. They might just be sort of businesses, what we call lifestyle businesses, where you're able to create a nice income for yourself and your family, and you're able to help a lot of other people, your employees, your community through that process. You're not going to be a bazillionaire. You're not going to be listed on NASDAQ. Your company's not going public, but it's a really solid important part of our community and our culture in the United States. And that's very possible. I think you are.
See more of that. And that's funny because that's kind of how I met Jack, was this workshop where we're looking at micro manufacturing, where you have somebody who's not going to be a gabillionaire, gajillionaire, but they're manufacturing and they're selling and they're making enough to where they're able to maybe move themselves up into middle class or even to upper middle class. Mm-hmm. And they're selling things that they're passionate about, that they're, you know, that's giving back to the community, and which I think is really neat. I certainly know some people in my life that are doing that. But going back to the investing, getting to that investing part, that's got to be a lot of fun as an entrepreneur when you finally get to that point. And it reminds me of, you know, Dave Ramsey getting to that point where you can start giving back to charity. And that's really the fun part, where the look that you get to see on people's faces when you say, I think what you're doing is really awesome, I want to invest in that. Like, that must be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's absolutely, you know, a game changer. And I've never been one to think that, you know, money can buy happiness, but I have been with, and I've been without, and I've been pretty happy with. So I don't know. I think it's possible to enjoy it and to let it be a blessing to other people, and to allow that to kind of permeate your life and that part of the process to be, you know, something that represents, you know, you and your family.
So, Mark, what's next for Mark Bendon? Again, you've done so many things that we haven't even talked about, but I know that you're still taking showers, and some of those end up to be more than 10 minutes, right? So out of those ideas, what are some things that you're working on that you're able to share with everybody?
Sure. So one of the fun areas that we've pivoted in recently in my lab here at Texas A&M was away from some of the physical interventions for things like sedentary behavior and get people to move more throughout the day, to the ability to give feedback through computer systems, through wearable sensors. And so when you monitor people for certain things like biomarkers or behaviors, what's happened in the past is we've tried to give people nudges to change behaviors. So, you know, a simple thing you might see in a building in a physical sense would be that if you enter a building and the first thing you see when you walk in the doors is a bank of six elevators, I mean, it's literally right in front of you, it's staring at you, there's a really high probability you're going to take the elevator to the second or third or fourth floor. But if when you walk into the building, the first thing you see is a really beautiful grand staircase with nice natural lighting, you know, easy to walk treads and nice handrails and lots of people traversing, you know, up and down, you're probably just going to start heading up the stairs. You're not even going to look for the elevators, right? And so people can be nudged to change behaviors in a way that's good for them, that helps them, just like they can be nudged in different directions. So in public health, one of the things we think about this is like peer pressure, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you have a problem, you know, with a substance abuse, for instance, you would not want to hang out with people who are utilizing those substances, right? That would be bad peer influence on you. Be a very strong negative influencer. So we can take healthy behaviors and we can nudge and encourage people. But what's happened in the past is in public health, we've used things like, say, a public service announcement. So I mentioned when I was a child, you know, there were a few very successful PSAs that were going on then. One was around stopping smoking. Mm. And at that point, wow, I think almost 40% of American adults smoked. And today it's, you know, 19 or 18%. It's dropped dramatically. And a lot of that has to do with that messaging. Another good example, you know, was the seatbelt. You know, we had seatbelts in vehicles. No one was using them. And people were dying. It was terrible. And so we started putting out PSAs for seatbelts. In fact, after a number of years, there was a group of people in our country who were really holdouts on seatbelt users, and that was the grandparents. Mm. And a funny thing happened. We gave up on messaging to the grandparents, and we went to the grandchildren. Mm-hmm. And the grandchildren converted the grandparents. they shamed the grandparents, you know, basically like, you don't love me, you don't want to wear your seatbelt, you know, and it worked. And the kids got to the grandparents and got them to change their behaviors. So we are trying to find right now for the modern office worker. And of course, today with COVID, and I think it would have been a thing no matter what, the remote worker, people working from home, how do we get them to engage in healthy behaviors? How do we get to break up their routine? How do we get them to have less stress, anxiety, depression, type 2 diabetes, obesity? So many of these things that we consider diseases of lifestyle. How do we give them feedback in a way that they will receive and that will be positive and that will, in fact, change their behaviors? And so these things need to be soft. They need to be subtle. They need to be not intrusive. There are a lot of privacy implications that come into play, particularly if it's a company deploying it rather than you going out and purchasing your smartwatch that tells you, you know, good job, you've been walking and exercising enough or whatever it is. And so, and again, we have to realize that not all people respond to the same nudges the same way. So a simple example for me, you know, I was in the Army, so a drill sergeant yelling at me motivates me and makes me want to do that thing, right? That's a good tactic to use on me. That might make somebody else cry. They may hate that. They may never want to hear that again. They may turn off that messaging if it's done in that manner. Whereas for me, that might just be great. That might be exactly what I need, right? Is the bugle call wake up at 5 a.m. to get up and go for a run. That might work for one individual. So we need to customize not just the information we're trying to give and the behaviors we're trying to nudge or modify. We need to, you know, transform the way that we do it. And we have to create systems that are smart. So where we've been to date in our lab and in the field with applied studies is we've been doing things that I would consider kind of digital hourglass. So a timer, you know, it's been an hour, Beth, you know, since you walked around. So walk around.
That certainly motivates me. My Apple Watch does it every there you go. Hour at the 50-minute mark. And it gets me up.
And the challenge with those things is we need to have them be smarter. And so where people lose interest is when the nudge is poorly timed or just flat out wrong, right? And so poorly timed would be you're engaged in the middle of a really important podcast and suddenly something starts beeping or vibrating or doing, and it's just an annoyance, right? It distracts you. Now, why didn't that thing know that you were engaged in a podcast? Why didn't it read your calendar, for instance, and see that you were on an important phone call and not have that prompt come up, save it for later, right? So we need to have those things do that. And the devices that we're testing right now, including some in both the mouse and the keyboard, they are able to intelligently understand the person, their patterns, their habits, their routines, and then through the computer, provide some of these nudges and feedbacks. One of the most exciting ones that we think we will have some good success with and some early indicators before COVID hit in the laboratory, we were seeing positive results, was on substance abuse. And if you've been following what's going on with substance abuse right now during the COVID, it's gone up dramatically. In fact, unfortunately, a lot of the opioid deaths have gone up even from last year's highs during the spring. So we have disease of despair on the rise, and we have anxiety and stress and depression. We've got economic influences. Of course, we have other health issues, isolation. So we really got a lot of opportunities through some of these technologies that we're working on now to get them out there and get them helping people. It's going to be a challenge, as always, again, with whether the company does this for you, to you, it starts to sound a little Orwellian. Or whether it's something you just go out and purchase for yourself because you want to be healthier and you want to, you know, have healthier behavior. So time will tell. We're early yet, but I'm very encouraged by early results.
I can see, if I understand you correctly, I could see if I'm, you know, a lawyer in my law firm and the firm says, Jack, I want you to wear this thing around your finger so I can see if you're, you know, abusing opioids or not. I'm like, I don't want to wear a thing around my finger. And the fact that you want to see if I'm abusing opioids makes me want to wear it even less, right?
Right.
But what I'm fascinated by is this idea that you can actually put it into the technology that I would already be using. And maybe a lawyer is a bad example. Maybe, you know, a nuclear reactor engineer like Homer Simpson would be,
sure.
You want something you really care about their, you know, their state, but you can actually put it into the computer, the augmentations to the computer, like the keyboard and the mouse, and you can track, you can track it through that.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's amazing because it's so non-intrusive. And even if I knew you were doing it, and I could understand it, I don't feel like there's a bracelet on me, you know, like an ankle bracelet or a wrist breaker or something like that. So that's fantastic. Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Very encouraging. So those digital fingerprints will be all part of what, you know, I think we'll most of us don't realize this, but we've probably already given up that little bit of privacy that we're sort of still worrying about.
Right.
With our devices, our smartphones especially. So,
right. And to the NSA, I want to let you know, I love you guys. You're awesome.
They are listening.
My FBI agent's name is Chris because every FBI agent I know is named Chris.
One-on-one, Agent Chris.
Oh,
yes.
Man.
Yes. And Mark, if you could figure out, the thing that always makes me mad with my Apple Watch is that I'll be standing in the kitchen for an hour cooking or cleaning, and then I get the nudge, hey, it's time to stand. And I'm like, I've been standing for the last, you know, hour and a half. And, you know, and then I'm really competitive. So then I get mad that, like, it wasn't counting it because, you know, I've got to have my
Beth, you bring up a good point.
So for me, that works.
Yeah.
A gamification too, right? So it's not just the sensor and the smartness of it, but how can I gamify it? So if somebody like Beth who says, oh no, before midnight, I need to get X number of things in, you know, you're going, it's going to be that nudge, right, too? Mm-hmm. So that's probably a part that you're looking at as well.
It is. And we've done that with employee groups where, you know, if the three of us were on a team, you know, we'd be competing against the other, you know, slacker team. Right, and, you know, that team would be the one to beat. And, now I wouldn't see Beth's score. She wouldn't see my score.
Right.
We would know as a team we were behind, and I could intuit from the data that, wow, I'm below the team average. It's probably me pulling us down. So I could kind of get on board and you know, contribute. But it wouldn't be necessarily be sort of a shaming thing where we would come around and go, hey, Beth, come on, you gotta get going here. What's the deal? You know, get some more points. So yeah, we're trying to work through that and understand. And again, there are situations and there are teams where that other approach might actually work. That might be great, and everybody might be willing to sign on for that. But I can assure you, there are probably way more cultures within industry in particular that wouldn't be an acceptable way to treat people. So we have to be careful. You know, we have to be careful. It's a really important bit of information. And part of this, Jack, one of the more sensitive things, believe it or not, more sensitive than the health data is the output data, the productivity data. So the software that we're working with can monitor, you know, how many keystrokes, how many words typed, how many errors per day, you know, how much output, right, on the computer. Scrolls, right clicks, left clicks, how many pixels on your screen the mouse travels. And so when you think of all these different data points, it's pretty easy. We're humans. We kind of want to compare. It's like, oh, well, I did 500 more words than you, you know, come on, slacker. And so, you know, now that doesn't sort of understand whether or not I was in an important meeting, not on my computer. Maybe I was inventing or creating or collaborating or doing something else that maybe isn't measured that way, that output, that objective output. And so we have to be really careful with this data and this information. I don't think it should be used as a club. I think it should be used for helpful purposes, for positive purposes. And a lot of the companies are already collecting this type of data. They even hide the employee identity from themselves. So it's almost like they don't trust themselves to know. So they're like, okay, we want to do this for altruistic reasons. So we're going to keep the names out of it, and we're going to see information, and we're going to feed back information to people, but we're not going to know who they are.
That might be
there are other companies who track it.
Might be one of the only ways of doing it in industries where you have, let's say, open shop unions, because I think the union reps would say, whoa. I don't care what you say. This is eventually going to be end up as part of their performance review or something like that. So that would also be an obstacle to the market, you know, to the adaptation in the market too. So
It's a great debate. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great debate.
Yeah. Well, Mark, tell us again, or tell the audience, what's the name of some of your companies, if you don't mind sharing, and where can we go to learn more information about what you're up to?
Sure. So we have been working lately trying to come up with something called the Wellbeing Code, and that is the name of the latest startup, and this is around some of this data collecting and data mining and digital fingerprints that I've been talking about. Past companies like Stand to Learn, sold off to Varidesk up in Dallas, who's now known as Vari, and then Positive Motion. Of course, I work for Johnson & Johnson and Neutral Posture, so lots of different things and products, inventions still out there, still being sold by those other companies that tie back to patents that I've got. So I think probably the next step forward with the Wellbeing Code, we've applied for some small business innovation research grants. The SBIR process is really important for inventors. It gives them early stage funding to sort of test their ideas, get some data, see if it's close to working. And then if it's really working reasonably well on a small scale, say a pilot study, you can get up to $1 million to spend a couple years doing a really thorough, deep investigative dive. And that's money that comes to the research labs at Texas A&M, typically for faculty inventors. And it's a great place to look for funding. I'm really not that good at that sort of thing. So when someone tells me that a particular granting or funding agency gives away, you know, 1 out of 6 applications, a grant or funding, and another one, say NSF or NIH, is 1 out of 12 or 1 out of 15, I'm the guy who really needs to go look at the 1 out of 6, because I'm probably not going to be the 1 out of 12, right? So I sort of know thyself, and know that I need to, you know, really look for money in certain places. And SBIRs is just a great, great place for faculty to find funding.
Yeah, I know that SBIR is a hot topic. We get a lot of questions from faculty about, hey, how do I write one? Can you look at my application? And we actually just did a YouTube video. You can find it on our YouTube about, there was a great webinar that Tech Transfer Central did about applying for SBIRs and kind of the components you really need to hammer in to be successful. And we kind of did like a follow-up to that with Megan Brown from our office. But I know we've asked you before to speak on panels about SBIRs because you've been successful with getting those, correct?
Correct. It's so important to have other examples and models and be able to look through other abstracts and, you know, get a feel for it. The two pieces of that SBIR, you know, sort of the invention, the research, and then the commercialization aspect are equally graded. And in fact, the panels that judge these, as faculty, we're used to having a lot of PhDs in our field judge our grant applications. That's really common. What we're not used to is having business people who are not in our field judge our applications. That's what happens with the SBIRs. You've got successful entrepreneurs, many of them who received SBIRs, and they are looking at the commercial potential. So it can't just be a cool research idea that's neat, that's in your field, that could easily, for instance, result in multiple publications. It can't just be that. There's going to have to be someone looking at your application saying, okay, I can see something coming from this that produces jobs, that creates opportunity, that produces a revenue stream. And that's where we really, as faculty, need a lot of help and insight from people like the iSchool and other successful entrepreneurs.
I would assume if faculty don't know about SBIRs, but they think that's something they're interested in, they should reach out to you, Beth, and say, hey, tell me more, at least as an entry point to figuring out what that path is and how you would get involved in that.
Yep. Yeah, and on that note, that's our show for today.
Yeah, my butt's getting sore. I need to stand up, Mark. Yeah, I need that sit stand podcast studio.
Yeah, you'd be like me and standing at my standing desk that Dr. Minden created. That's our show for today. We would like to thank Mark. Thank you for being here today. Please make sure that you like, subscribe, whatever medium you are listening to. Please leave us a review, leave us a comment. We would love to hear from you. So leave us a comment, send us an email. You can head over to tamuip.tamu.edu. Send me, your host, Beth Durmeyer, an email. We would love to hear from you. We would love to hear your suggestions. So, signing off, I am Beth Durmeyer.
And I'm Jack Manheyer.
And we will see you next time on Idea to Impact.